everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Once again, my good friend, Dr. Linda DeVillers, and a colleague is with me. Welcome back to this program, Dr. Linda.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm so glad. So you were last here the end of about a month ago, and we talked about ending long-term relationships and the gray divorce and that sort of thing. Today we're going to talk about narcissism and relationships, and this is a big topic. Linda, we did our pre-interview yesterday, but I sent you an outline. I hope you got that. About an hour ago.
I got it about 15 minutes ago, but yes, I have it.
Yeah, it wasn't quite so long. All right, good, Linda. Linda's a trooper, and Linda's a professional, and she's a professor, and she is the author of two books. Simple, we've talked about them on the show a few times, Simple Sexy Food, 101 Tasty Aphrodisiac Recipes, and Sensual Tips to Stir Your Libido and Feed Your Love, and also Love Skills. And we've talked about these books before, and you don't have a book on narcissism, but you have experience with clients with narcissism, as I do. And in the course of our personal lives, we may have encountered narcissists because they're fairly common. We're as bosses, sometimes as bosses, as friends, as but the hardest ones really are if your loved one is a narcissist. So we're going to kind of focus in on that. How's that sound to you, Linda?
Sounds very good, yes.
Good, good. So overt narcissism, you know, we can talk about the guy who's boastful and arrogant and the center of attention, and maybe he gets angry when everyone questions his authority. And then there may be the woman who could be outwardly unassuming, but she's equally self-centered and very touchy, very sensitive. And both of these people that I've just made up feel entitled to whatever they want. And so these people have the classic personality traits of a narcissist. NPD, right? Narcissistic Personality Disorder. Do you come across these very often in your practice?
Yes, I would say I do fairly often. And I think it's fair to say that there is a stereotype that, and I think the research supports it, that in terms of our overt or very exhibitionistic narcissists, they are more often male. And so when I work with couples, indeed, that has been one of the tendencies, to see the overt male narcissist with a more or less self-effacing woman. But I totally agree with you that there are women who are definitely overtly narcissistic as well.
Yeah, I think from what I've read, there are more men in the United States who are overtly narcissistic than women. But what about the covert narcissists? And you know, you sent me a document that's really very complete on the covert narcissists. And can you tell me and our listeners?
Yes,
about the covert narcissists?
I find it fascinating. Now, the term was first introduced by a very high profile psychiatrist who was actually psychoanalytic in orientation. And way back when, in the early 90s, he wrote a book called The Emerging Self. And I remember being inspired to get his book because I was working with a client who had sort of a male who had sort of interesting set of of characteristics or symptoms. And somebody had told me you might like this. And so that was my first introduction to the concept. And I think many people have never really heard this term, overt, or some people even call it closet narcissism. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of the flip side of our covert, our overt person, that these are people, for example, who are a little bit more likely to tell you that when they grew up, they were very shy.
Yes.
And I, you know, that's kind of a very interesting thing, because we usually think of shy people as being mostly neurotic in the old term. But we don't, you know, we don't usually associate shyness with narcissism. But it's sort of the flip side of the flaming narcissist, so that in a certain way, it's even harder to deal with this kind of person, because it's more subtle, and mm-hmm. it presents in rather different ways. I'm looking at your outline, and I see you have down childhood influences, and I think it's fair to say that, you know, possibly because of shyness or whatever, that these are probably kids that were not really acknowledged as much as they should have been mm-hmm. by a parent, or in the case of one client I can think of, his childhood involved being in a military family and moving around a lot. So it was mm-hmm, harder to establish firm attachments. And I don't know that I think of massive abuse. It could be massive abuse, but that something in that childhood experience was lacking, and that led to some sort of an attachment disorder.
Yes, yes, because we know that a solid sense of self is really the bedrock for life, and Sigmund Freud theorized, and I think that modern research confirms this, that the sense of who you are develops between the ages of 1 and 3, and that's when the small child comes to understand that he is important, but not necessarily the center of the universe.
Right.
So. Yeah. So when something goes wrong in the process, and perhaps the parent is too indulgent, or maybe the parent is too self-absorbed, and we talk about the narcissistic wound, this is sometimes the right. mother who is really narcissistic herself, too self-absorbed to really pay attention to her child. And so that sense of self is in the child is stunted. And there's a larger-than-life fantasy of self-importance that protects him from the reality that he's never learned to accept. I remember going to, when I lived in Palo Alto, so this has to be 30 years ago, and hearing a lecture on the narcissistic personality, and at that time, because I was still fairly new as a therapist, this was brand new news, and I remember the guy talking about how the child develops as a teenager too, continues to develop a false sense of self,
exactly.
and so they have to
right.
protect that. Yes, and so a lot of times the narcissistic man doesn't let anybody in, but trappings are really important. So having a beautiful home, maybe a beautiful partner on his arm. All of these trappings, just the wealthy person who is
right.
very self-absorbed and doesn't want to really let anybody in to see his true self. So that is definitely a big childhood influence.
Right, and maybe I'd like to add, just because it's something that I have noticed, not just in my practice, but sort of people in the world. You know, there's the person who's the boaster, who and as you said, really has to have the, you know, the best car and show off this and that, who's more exhibitionistic about their narcissism. But there's something I haven't actually seen in the literature, but it makes sense to me. I'm going to call it reflected glory. So by that, I mean, this person may, or in the covert form, this person may or may not have the fanciest car.
Yeah.
But I'm best friends with the guy down the street who has a Tesla. Or I met so-and-so. And it's so striking to me. And in a way, to me, it's just so obvious that that's what's going on. This person is latching on to the high status of somebody else, and it could even be a significant other, partner, to boost their own sense of self and self-esteem.
And perhaps we could say that, generally speaking, a lot of the entourages of celebrities could be in this category.
Yes.
Especially if they're more than just an odd fan. I mean, if they're really in that inner circle.
And, oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. That would
and
be.
So
great.
I think that's a good term, Linda. I like that, reflected glory.
Yeah.
And sometimes that might doesn't always have to be the man with the money. It could be the woman with the money, and
of course,
the man doesn't have as much money but he gets some reflected glory by being in a relationship with her.
Right. And you know, that would be an interesting thing. I don't know of a study on it, but it would be whether or not, if the woman is officially the higher status person, whether a man with narcissistic issues would more often present as the covert narcissistic version as opposed to the flamboyant type.
My guess is it would be true.
Yep, I think so too.
Yes, yes. This is, you know, I was thinking back, I've never spent in the 11 years that I've been doing this program, Love, Lust, and Laughter on Progressive Radio Network, I've never done an entire show on narcissism, and I think it's about time. So I'm really glad to be talking with you about this. So let's talk about who is the narcissist. And so we have, I want to talk about with you about shamelessness and entitlement and arrogance and exploitation and bad boundaries and all of these kinds of behavior are persistent and pervasive in order to qualify for the narcissistic, the NPD, narcissistic personality disorder. Yes. So let's start with shamelessness. You know, feeling flawed is painful for anyone, of course. But for the narcissist, shame is often unbearable. So he'll wall himself off behind denial. Maybe there's, instead of denial, there might be coldness, or there might even be rage, really a lot of anger. So where others might feel shame, he feels unfairly attacked or blames others. There's a lot of blaming in narcissism.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, that it's sort of first cousin of this concept both versions of narcissists have, but it's being very hypersensitive to criticism because of the shame that it would bring to the person if they thought they were less than wonderful. That's something I have seen a lot. And we know that in everyday relationships, and, you know, we could even talk about Gottman's work on making a distinction between an open, what's the word he uses, complaint versus criticism. So one might be making a complaint, which is a legitimate thing to do, And our narcissistic person is going to immediately hear the specific complaint as an overblown criticism and react with that narcissistic rage response, which is classic.
It is classic. Yes, Gottman is famous for, you know this, but the listeners may not know. He studied for 40 years. He looked at couples, wired them up and all of that. He was right here at the I live in Seattle, the University of Washington. And he had a little apartment on Lake Washington, or maybe it was Lake Union. But anyway, he had this apartment, and that was the love lab, where couples that were newly together and couples who'd been together a long time were sent, and they were wired for heartbeat, and even their urine was tested, and all of
blood
that.
Blood pressure,
Blood pressure, yes. And so he got a lot of really good information, and so going from a criticism to more of attacking, it really hitting below the belt line, the emotional belt line.
Let me offer an example for your listeners.
I'd love Yes.
And he did find that criticism is not a good thing. You always leave your clothes on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I did more than one bad thing there. It was you, it was global, or actually I was more specific, but I added that word always, which is not good. Versus, I don't like it when you leave the clothes on the floor. Sometimes I stumble on them. In my second example, I've been very specific. And the other one, I shouldn't have said clothes. I should have said, you always leave a mess. I've been vague, exaggerated, and it's that you always stuff that's our massive criticism, but the I don't like it when is a specific complaint. And if you're going to have ongoing relationships, you do need to be able to express that without triggering a massive defensive response.
Absolutely. And I think it could be useful to use an empathic confrontation where you can demonstrate that you appreciate how the other person feels, but you also then can make an unambiguous statement of how you feel and what you need. And sometimes that's very hard for the narcissist to hear. But my example would be that the partner, the spouse, comes home an hour after you were planning dinner again and says, so I'm late, okay? I'm tired. I don't want to hear about any of your complaints. Let's eat. And I think it's very helpful. I've worked with clients on this issue. What not to say, don't you dare talk to me that way. But instead you can say, I know you're the boss at work, but I'm not one of your subordinates. Our relationship doesn't work that way. And I know you're exhausted and you've had a tough day, but I'm allowed to be disappointed when you're late. It's been three times this week. So
That's great.
She's saying exactly what she needs and wants, but she's not hitting below the emotional belt line.
That's right.
So how you handle it is crucial.
And let's say the example you just gave, what's interesting about it is that one of the difficulties that often somebody in a relationship with a narcissist is faced with is, they cower and it really does make them feel, it diminishes their own self-esteem. But the response you gave was very articulate, and it was honest and specific.
Mm-hmm.
And assertive.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Let's go on to the second one.
Yes.
Entitlement. What would you say about entitlement?
I have
a lot of things to say about it, but I'd like to have you start here.
What do I want to say about entitlement? Well, I think either version of our narcissism do feel entitled. In fact, you're that I want to eat now, so I'm going to eat now. So I'm entitled to that. I'm entitled to have things work or happen the way I want them to. I think, again, it's just a matter of subtlety, that the covert person is a little bit more subtle about that, what they feel entitled to. Or maybe they don't express it until it's actually challenged. I don't instantly think of an example. I'm sure I will, but let me hear what you have to say, and maybe it will trigger me.
Well, I wanted to talk about that the background is likely that the narcissist has never lost that infant's conviction of being the center of the universe.
That's
benign
true narcissism.
We expect that in little babies. They're adorable. It's just that when they're 25 years old or 45 years
Correct.
Old, it's not so adorable because he wants what he feels he should get, and he expects others to meet his needs and reflect how wonderful he is. And rules, they're for other people. A lot of times this is the sentiment.
You know, this triggers in me even some personal childhood experiences that were positive, that my parents always were very consistent, but if we wanted something that we didn't absolutely need, it was, I guess you'll save your pennies and you'll figure out how to get it. One example I recall, and I was probably only 8 or 9 years old, is that I wanted a radio. And it's not that my parents couldn't have bought me a radio. I'm sure they could have. But it was, that seems like something that I encourage you to earn. And the other example I could give has to do with corrective lenses. And certainly when I became short-sighted and, you know, myopic, they certainly had me checked and I had glasses. But when I said I would like contact lenses, I was in high school senior, I believe, and my mother said to me, well, we think it would be nice if you earned the money to buy your contacts. I'm talking about the fact that probably it predisposes to narcissism when you have parents, possibly of better means, who are constantly indulging their children and unfortunately reinforcing that they are the center of the universe and they get just anything they want.
Well, that does happen, and that is the so-called spoiled child. And so that reinforces the sense of entitlement. I can get whatever I want. And like you, I had to earn what I wanted. And from very young, just like you, I think we ended up with secure attachment. And of course, attachment plays a big role in all of our life and our adult relationships. You and I are a similar generation, so we know about this. But when I first started babysitting, it was 25 cents an hour, and then it went up to 50 cents.
Right.
Anyway, it took me. I loved babysitting, and I started
so
at age 11. Yeah.
Right.
And my father said, because it was just a given that we would go to college, my father said, for every dollar you make babysitting, I will match that dollar, and it'll go into the bank in the college fund account. And I thought that was very good. And it kept me motivated, and I knew I was going to go to college. And and the work ethic got instilled. But it was the opposite. We both have pretty good examples. The opposite of developing a sense of entitlement. There's also arrogance. Arrogance. If the narcissist isn't better than everyone else, he's worthless. I mean, this is the feeling he has. He he can sort of trumpet his accomplishments, and maybe in the process he puts down others.
Yes.
He might have an actual sense of superiority that masks the fragility of his own self-esteem. You know, it's like a big show, right? That kind of arrogance.
You know, I think what that sort of segues into, too, is that since I deserve the best room in the hotel, and that's too bad if you're on your honeymoon and you thought you were going to get that room. But, you know, we're talking about people who have a lack of empathy for others. I mean, it's a classic sign.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you read the material I sent you, we know that sometimes this covert narcissist can appear to be a little more empathic. But one of the things I noticed was, for example, I'm thinking of a friend who was like this, and we might watch a movie, and this person is in tears in this movie because, I don't know, something sad has happened to the protagonist. But when you hear them elaborate on this, it's because it reminds them of something that happened in their life. So I don't know if that's making sense to you, but it's not a really true.
No, it absolutely does. One of my clients, just she's a woman over 50, and she just, her boyfriend of, I don't know, 6 months, broke up with her by text. And just recently, and I was looking back over my notes because I had a session with her yesterday, and she remembered that he talked with tears in his eyes about a friend's bad situation. But then when it came to himself, he could never evoke any personal sentiments about to be vulnerable. He couldn't be vulnerable and talk about himself, but he could identify with his friends. But I think that's, you brought up something that I hadn't really thought about. It reminded him of something that happened to him in his youth when he felt completely out of control.
Right. And my point is that ultimately, you know, if you suddenly are crying or whatever, strong emotion, but it's because it reminds you of something so much in your own life. It's about me, 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 me.
Yeah.
And
it's just
not other focused.
Yeah. The two self-involved person.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about exploitation. Because this narcissistic person lacks empathy, the feelings for others aren't quite real to the narcissist.
Right.
So we have acquaintances, employees, spouses are there to be used, period.
Exactly.
So there is that exploitation.
Right.
And that's what makes a narcissistic boss so, I'm veering away, but of course, that is a relationship, employee-boss, but that makes a narcissistic boss especially difficult.
Right. And I think what you're referring to, too, is that it connects to the entitlement. I'm entitled to ask you to stay late after work. No, I really don't need to pay you anything extra because, after all, you were supposed to get that done before 5. It's very exploitive, you know.
Yeah. And it's all about, as are lots of things in relationships, about expectations.
Right.
And assumptions, and they haven't been checked out. You find, just in general, expectations and making assumptions that haven't been checked out gets a lot of people into trouble.
Indeed. Yeah, that is so true.
So I want to talk next, because this is all about who is the narcissist. So we've talked about shamelessness and entitlement and arrogance, exploitation, and bad boundaries. We each have separate selves, and I would say that we're also, I bring in a little bit of Dr. David Snarch. You know, isn't it amazing that he died in 2020? I was just shocked.
He did? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't. He had a sudden heart attack, and he was only like early 60s. Yeah,
oh, wow.
he contributed so much to our field, didn't he, about the whole differentiation thing. And to be well-differentiated is to have good boundaries and to not, and it enables you to be in a relationship and in including a sexual relationship, and we're going to get to sexual narcissism eventually here. A sexual without any fears, and you have your own boundaries, and you can merge and have an experience ecstasy at times, but not be afraid that you'll be engulfed or overwhelmed if you're really well differentiated. And narcissists never developed a sense of self, so they have poor boundaries. The sense where they end and others begin. That's kind of about boundaries.
Right.
And they also may not respect other people's privacy or property.
Let me give you an example. I worked with a woman fairly recently who, you know, this is secondhand, but anyway, she was describing the kinds of things that disturbed her about what clearly sounded to me like a narcissistic partner. And of course, the narcissistic partner never came into therapy because he didn't need to be fixed. She did. It was all that scenario.
That's right.
But in any event, the examples she gave were things like that her husband had a tendency that if they had a conversation, I'll just give a couple of examples. But she said, so she was talking to him about maybe it'd be fun to have a particular couple over for dinner. And it was right after COVID. Anyway, it was like, we can finally do that. And so she made this suggestion fairly late at night, 9:30 or 10. And he said to her, oh, let's call them now. And then she was having to say, no, I just made a suggestion. You like the idea? We'll take care. I'll call in the morning. You know, there was no understanding about boundaries with regard to time frames.
Exactly. Or
know,
maybe.
Or
yeah.
You know,
or maybe they've already gone to bed.
I'll call
and we don't
now. I'd like
them.
To talk to them at 6 in the morning, or it's 10:30 at night. And unless these are people you know are night owls or whatever, you know, this is not acceptable. But it's like, oh, I like that. I like that. Let's do it right now. What?
Yeah. So there's...
Anyway, just odd.
So I think maybe what comes into play here is impulse control, a lack of impulse control.
Well, and another... It's a beautiful example of I can't step out of myself and into the shoes of another. And
oh, that's so true, yes.
What this person might be doing right now, like sleeping or whatever, no sense of that.
Because they don't have the empathy. They don't have the empathy. You know, there's American Indians, or indigenous people, I guess we call them now. They said you have to walk in somebody's moccasins for at least 20 miles before you can really understand them. And so I use that in my when I'm doing couples counseling. Occasionally, I will ask them to trade roles and to answer as their spouse or their partner might answer and deal with it. So they can. And some people are good at this, and guess what? Others are not. They really have trouble being in the shoes of their partner.
Right.
So that's a very good point, Linda.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, yes. So let's go on and talk about living with a narcissist, because that can be a challenge.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we can talk about how good relationships are based on reciprocity. You listen attentively and empathically to the other person's joys and sorrows, for example, and right. she listens to yours, or he listens to yours.
Right.
And with
right.
narcissists, it's a one-way street. It's a steady diet. A steady diet of this can really be toxic to your sense of self.
Right.
There isn't that reciprocity.
Say that again.
Reciprocity. There isn't that sense,
right.
you know,
right.
and the healthiest relationships have that. There's an equal give and take.
Right.
And, yeah.
And there
it's
are
not
apologies
a one-way street.
When apologies are appropriate, you know. I don't mean
mm-hmm.
chronic apologies, but I mean, I'm sorry, I snapped a little and I shouldn't have done that. I would
yes.
say, and the thing, to me, one of the things that's such a key aspect of whether a person living with a narcissist is completely demoralized or not, is whether they internalize or they take in the lashing out that comes at them. You know, you're a stupid
yeah.
moron, you whatever.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Whatever might be thrown at them, I'm afraid I think some people are much more vulnerable to, you know, taking that as a valid response, as opposed to, I don't know how to put it, it can sound weird, but I've known people who can really let it roll out right off their back. This is your this is a manifestation of your problem, not my pathology.
Yeah, I want to give an I so agree with you. I want to give an example. So another example of this. So your partner talks at length about a series of frustrating encounters with a friend and then starts reading an email on his cell phone when you start to describe your day. So,
oh, right.
Right. And then I think it's a good idea to say, not to say, I can't believe how selfish you are.
Right. No.
And then instead, what to say, it sounds like you've had a lot to deal with today, and I know you like to stay on top of your email. But relationships are a two-way street. I care about you and would like to feel that you are caring for me too. And that
right.
really comes under the heading again of empathic confrontation. Now, whether
right.
your narcissistic partner is going to hear this is up for debate. I mean, they may not, but there are ways to do this confrontation and ways not to do it. And
right.
it often makes a difference if you can get through to the to
right.
your narcissistic partner.
Exactly. And
yeah.
I'm afraid I think that, you know, that's sort of easier said than done. It would be interesting to know just exactly what that person who receives that feedback is going to do in terms of whether they will actually respond or whether they say, well, I'm sorry, but I just really need to check this.
And oftentimes it's the latter. I hear this in my practice.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's, you know, what research has shown that narcissism is a very difficult thing to change.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It's deeply embedded, and those wonderful documents you sent me on covert narcissism
right.
talks about that too. It's part. Well, I'm reading now the front page of what you sent me. In reality, NPD, narcissistic personality disorder isn't that simple. It occurs on a broad spectrum that involves a range of potential traits. And the four distinct subtypes, and one of them is what we've been talking about, covert narcissism, called also, by the way, that I learned from this document, also called vulnerable narcissism. But it's so ingrained in the personality that it's very often difficult to change. And you talked about a client coming in whose partner was a narcissist and said, "You need to be fixed." Oh, I've heard this before, too.
Yeah,
you
I know, so many times.
And the narcissist rarely comes for therapy.
Right.
I figured out now, I've been doing this work for 40 years. I used to say 35, but no, it's 40 years because I got my master's and started in 1981 and then started on my 3 years of internship in California before I could go to Sacramento and take the written and then in those days also an oral exam. These are challenging. These are challenging cases.
Let me bring up something
else.
I've seen a few. With regard to therapy, and you'll see it in the materials I sent you, that the vulnerable narcissist, you know, with their shyness and so forth, is also more prone to anxiety and depression.
Yes, that's right.
Then the exhibition. So the catch is that when, and I'm thinking very specifically of a client I saw more recently, where they're very aware of their depression or their anxiety, sometimes even having anxiety attacks, that they're landing in, and I think naive therapists are assuming that that is their primary problem. When what's really going on is that the covert narcissism is the foundation of these other symptoms that are showing up, and that they are more often treated for that, and or that's what they go into therapy for. It doesn't even remotely occur to them that they have a narcissistic issue.
And that's right. And they may finally get into therapy because they're experiencing so much pain with the anxiety and the depression. And the experienced therapist will dig a little further and help them find out, you know, getting that first session where you hear about the family of origin and to see if there can be some narcissistic aspects. And, of course, we all have some narcissism. But we want to have it be healthy narcissism, which sort of boosts our self-esteem, and it's not toxic or pathological. Right. So I really want to, because my program is love, lust, I want to talk about sexual narcissism, because in the bedroom, and this is true also in the boardroom, but sexual narcissists really require constant stroking. And I had a client, this will be an example of quite literal stroking. My client, 31 years old, and a former boyfriend that she described, insisted on long back rubs after every lovemaking session, but would never rub hers in return. What she remembered, she said, "At first I thought those back rubs were just wonderful. I mean, at least he didn't fall asleep." But she said, "You know, half an hour is a long time to rub someone's back, especially if he'll never do it for you." And he said his hands were tired because he'd worked at the drafting board all day. Well, she said, "I work at the computer all day, and my fingers get tired too." So that's sexual narcissism. And then entitlement comes in there again, doesn't it?
Well, and the exploitation. Let's call that rather exploitive to have it be a one-way street.
One-way street,
yeah,
yes.
Actually, uncannily, in a social setting about a week ago, a woman who was ending a relationship said that, anyway, the person she wants to end it with, and she was talking about his erection problems, but that he wanted her to sleep every single night, that he required that she hold on to his penis. And
while
that
she's
was
sleeping?
Just his requirement.
Well, that's, I think, unreasonable. Go to heaven.
And a little peculiar and whatever. But anyway, I had never heard that one before.
Perfectionism is comes in here too, because a lot of narcissists are really well, narcissism is closely tied to perfectionism, and of course that makes them demanding often and hypercritical of others. But the perfectionism can come out in the bedroom when, especially for women, that they want to have a perfect image. She has to feel really great about her body. It has to be perfect or she can't express passion. And
right.
Years ago, I had a client, a professional dancer, and she would just obsess about her weight. And she was, well, let's see, she was maybe 5'7", and she weighed about 110 pounds. So,
oh, my goodness. Yeah, okay.
But she was unable to make love if the scale showed she had gained even a pound. I used to work more with eating disorders, and this is fairly common. And so what her lover, the reason she changed, and she was had narcissistic aspects, of course, and her lover said, "I'm going to leave you if you don't get some help for this and some therapy." And so she said that he did, she reflected on that and said, "He did me a favor because I'd always thought it was perfectly normal to refuse sex if I didn't look exactly right."
Okay.
"And I just could never make love with a cold or even a pimple on my face or during my period. I was never, never able to forget about myself in bed." And, you know, she said, "Other people could see me as vain, but deep down I felt ugly and undesirable." That's the deep down thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to have a really good sexual relationship requires, oh, letting go completely and abandoning yourself to the moment. And as an older, I can personally say I'm aware of my more wrinkly body now in my 70s, but I'm having such a great time and there's so much acceptance on the part of my husband that I don't even think about it. Not usually.
No.
In my youth, I was more concerned with chubby thighs and this or that.
Right.
But,
and that's why we know that one of the classic U of Chicago studies, national survey, found that on average, women in their 20s had significantly worse body image than the women in their 50s. And it's because women over time, hopefully, become more accepting and more secure and more sexually assertive as well. They know more what they want and they're able to ask for it, et cetera. That's one of the beauties of aging, actually.
Yes, and that reminds me of Gail Sheehy's book, going back to the 70s, The Passages, and she said that somewhere over 50, there's that crossover effect, and the man's anima, his female side, emerges, so he's better able to slow down and be more tender and sensitive.
Right.
And her animus, this is Carl Jung, comes to the forefront, and she's able to be more assertive and say what she wants and needs. And she realizes that she knows her body best, and so she can say what she wants and needs. And that's very empowering, and a lot of times younger women don't have that sense of empowerment or confidence, body confidence.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about sexual narcissism that I want to talk about is for especially for men, but sometimes for women, there's a compulsive need for new conquests.
Yes.
And I want to give an example of this. A woman broke off her engagement to an actor. She returned home and she found him in bed with another woman.
Uh-huh.
And and he said, with tears in his eyes, he said, I know I'll never find a more loving woman than you. And he probably meant it, but she said she complimented him a lot, but her praise wasn't enough for him. He had to hear from it hear from more than one voice. He had to see himself in more than one woman's eyes. So we have a number of narcissistic men, probably more covert than overt, probably, who are philanderers. They need this new conquest. And so, and I think what goes along with that perhaps is that a lot of these guys have trouble, these narcissists have trouble working on relationships. Once they get beyond the first blissful stage of falling in love. And so when other people talk about working out problems, the narcissists often will back off because they don't want to think about improving things. They only want to hear how wonderful they are.
Right.
And isn't that sad? That's sad.
Yeah, that is. Right.
Yeah.
I think the philandering is probably a little more common in the, we'll call them the flaming narcissist, than the covert. Not to say it couldn't happen with both, but
yeah, I thought I said that, but maybe I mixed up.
Oh, I apologize if you did say that.
Yeah. I did say that because the overt one is the one who's out there and he's more flamboyant and extroverted, and so the covert narcissist doesn't have maybe that kind of confidence. And
exactly.
What else do you think?
I think it's the overt too, who will be more, more irritating. You do hear, sadly, a lot more women than men say, once he's finished, he's done,
Yes, that's right.
And
that's right.
That to me is a very narcissistic behavior,
Oh, yeah.
Not to care that much about your partner's satisfaction.
One of the first things I remember learning in the field of sex therapy, so this is going back 38 years maybe, was that post-coital behavior is very revealing.
Yeah.
And especially if you're a single woman and you've been having sex and the guy jumps up and can't wait to take a shower and go home.
But it
isn't there to just snuggle and to talk loving things and to say reminisce how wonderful it was, warm and wonderful it was. So, yes.
Well, I was going to say, believe it or not, way back when, I worked with a couple that were not married, and I can't recall if they were cohabiting or not, but they felt like a pretty solid couple. They'd been together almost a year, but there was what we could call a role reversal, and the issue was that the man wanted slow, attentive lovemaking, and she was the quick and dirty one, and in the sense that she wanted no nonsense. Let's do it, get me off. And she was the one that would just roll over, which was quite unusual. And therapy sort of limped along. They ended therapy, and I ran into him a couple months later in a supermarket or someplace, and he said, thank you, it helped me decide that I really needed to end the relationship, which I'd sort of been trying to say anyway. But that was an intriguing situation where it was flipped.
flipped.
But either way, it's not good.
It's not, does not make for a healthy relationship. So let's talk a little bit about what to do, what you can change or not in, if you're in a relationship with a narcissist. And I think it's important to remember that, it's necessary to realize that no amount of effort on your part is going to fill these narcissists up, to complete them as human beings. They've got this dark hole that can't be filled up, no matter how much you try. And that can be very depressing for somebody who's decided to stay in a relationship with a narcissist. And for those who wonder, am I in a relationship with a narcissist? I think the best way to identify if you are in a relationship with a narcissist is it's how they make you feel. Because offloading onto others the emotions they can't handle. So that might be their shame, their rage, their inadequacy. So that...
Yes, and their self-pity. That's the one I've seen a lot of.
Their self-pity. Exactly.
Yeah, a lot.
Self-pity.
Mm-hmm.
So then by word and also in their behaviors, they can make the other person feel ashamed, angry, inadequate. And oftentimes the process is unconscious on both sides. So
I
would say to anybody listening that if you feel unaccountably bad around someone, this could be why.
Exactly.
That you're with somebody who offloads their emotions. They can't handle it themselves, so they offload. It can be very hard to face the fact that someone close to you is abusive or exploitive or very selfish. But the alternative is sacrificing your needs to preserve the illusion is worse. It's worse. It's better to break off rather than to suffer.
Well, and you're hinting at maybe you need to leave this relationship.
Exactly.
And oftentimes that is the healthiest thing to do. I think it leads to our basic thing about, you know, how can you navigate this? I think it's fair to say it could well be useful for the non-narcissistic person to get into therapy to help recognize all of this stuff and then to start heavily weighing the pros and cons of staying in the relationship and looking at things that might be, well, but most of the time it's good. You know, and well, is that actually accurate? Or is that really good enough? And really take a long, hard look at the situation and whether there are specific things that could conceivably change or not.
We've had a very enlightening conversation today, dear friend, Dr. Linda DeVillers. Her website will be in my show notes, drlindadevillers.com. Thank you, Linda. Once again, you bring so much wisdom and experience to these conversations, and I appreciate you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
We'll do it again.
Not
too distant future, Linda. Take good care.
All right. I say
and
goodbye to all the listeners, too. It's great to be with
you.
Yes,
and the listeners. And I hope this was helpful and informative. And we'll do more in 2 weeks. I'll have another show in 2 weeks with Dr. Michael Castleman.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. Take good care, everybody. And have some fun. Have some good sex.
Okay, bye-bye.
Ti divertirai. Che traguardi vuoi farmi?